Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody do your job.
And together we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
I'm Tom Maroney.
And I'm Peter Barnes with Pat Carroll.
On our program tonight, what bothers the Boston business community? Tariffs? Parking? My shopping habits? All of the above? Well, no. Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce CEO and President Jim Rooney joins us with his answer. We'll also ask Mr. Rooney if the mayor's move to keep Starbucks out of the North End was a good one, and whether Boston-based GE, its stock slumped further today, still represents a positive investment for the city of Boston.
Plus, State Street Bank makes a big acquisition, but investors don't like it. They pushed the shares down 7%. Our Boston Bureau finance guru, Charlie Stein, will join us to discuss this and other stories in his weekly Stein on Money report. We're following the GE story here. The company shares down 4% today, even though it beat expectations on earnings and revenue in its quarterly report. But investors very worried about the power division. John Flannery and company are having a difficult time trying to turn around the power division. They cut cash flow expectations and made other announcements about it. And so investors now clearly worried about the company's turnaround plan.
Well, you know, our reporting says, Peter, that slumping demand for gas turbines is at the heart of all this. And one has to wonder, again, their projections were off somewhere along the line, and Flannery forced on a conference call today to say that this turnaround on the power business is yet to materialize. So here we go again. Another shoe drops.
Our Bloomberg Intelligence folks say that the end markets are not cooperating with the turnaround in the power division. Double-digit declines in GE power and oil and gas, dragging down GE's organic growth and offsetting strength in aerospace and healthcare. And, of course, one of the big questions for investors is, what about the future of the dividend? A lot of investors are in this stock, have been in this stock over time because of the dividend, which is now about 3.6%. And the company has issued guidance that as it tries to do all this restructuring, the dividend also itself could be net once it, it's spinning off its healthcare technology division and other things. But for more on this, we're joined now by our own analyst from Bloomberg Intelligence on all of it, Karen Ubelhart, who's been writing about the issues.
It's been a long day,
GE.
Karen. I heard you at 6 a.m.
That's correct. Karen, you were quoted by our Bloomberg News Department saying power is still really bad. When are we going to find the bottom? So let me ask you the question. When do we find the bottom here?
I thought we'd start to see some stabilization. I mean, we've still got the capacity problems. They've got to cut a lot of capacity. But I thought, when you're down 50% or 60%, you might start to see some stabilization. I can't give you an answer, but it's certainly not this year. What they now think is that we're going to see the same level of gigawatt purchases, which is how they count it, for three years, like through 2020. I'm not sure that they know. So the bottom line is, and what freaked people out, not so much that it didn't turn yet, but is that big program, that restructuring program, enough? Or we're going to have round two.
Right.
And
what's your sense of that?
I think they are going to have another round. And they have some problems here. Like, they can't cut in Austin, for example. There's a lot of obstacles to cutting people. In fact, in France, they're supposed to be adding 1,000 people because that was the deal they cut with Austin. So they have some structural problems there.
So the company today reaffirming its annual earnings guidance of $1 to $1.07 a share. It's paying a 48 cents of that a year out in the dividend. And we know that with the spinoff of the healthcare technology division, which makes the MRIs and all that other stuff, and that's going to be a publicly traded company, there's going to be some adjustment to the dividend yet again. What did Flannery and his team say about that today?
They did not. The dividend did not come up, and that's because they have stated that they're going to maintain the dividend until healthcare is spun, and healthcare won't be spun for 12 to 18 months. So that's why I don't think.
But the expectation is that net-net, it's going to be a lower dividend than what it is now, that 12 cents a share.
Those that will get, the shareholders will get health care. So whatever dividend health care pays, they'll get that. But GE itself, the new GE, will have a smaller dividend.
Karen, as we wrap this up, what's the next time we'll hear from Flannery? Is there a scheduled conference calls or an announcement, anything on the books this summer?
No. We've got, he's almost done with the $20 billion deal, which was round one. We know the proceeds for all of those businesses. Now it's execution. I think GE speaks at a lot of different conferences, so we may get incremental information at these conferences, but no big announcements. I think he did that in June, and now people are going to watch the operations and
the execution.
And
now.
The execution.
Here, going forward.
Yes.
All right, Karen Ubelhart, Bloomberg Intelligence Analyst, thank you for your time today. We continue to watch GE, now based in Boston, of course. Coming up, what worries the Boston business community? Well, we got a lot to talk about with Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce CEO and President Jim Rooney. He's out in Iowa at a big convention of chambers of commerces, but we're going to get him on the Starbucks. The mayor said no Starbucks at this particular location in the North End. Was that a good move? Well, to ask him about GE and a lot of other things Mr. Rooney has going on. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. It's Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore. All right, so now we're going to turn to a man who I'm sure, he'll tell you he doesn't know everything, but he knows a lot. He is Jim Rooney. He's the president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. He happens to be on the road this afternoon. He's in Iowa, of all places, at an annual meeting of Chambers of Commerces. So, Jim, welcome to the program. Glad you could take some time this afternoon. What are you doing in Iowa, for goodness sakes?
Well, my first trip to Des Moines, Iowa, and it's an annual meeting of people involved in running chambers of commerce, big and small, cities and towns all over the country, about 1,000 people, and get together once a year and just talk about what's going on in our local business communities.
I've heard there's a lot of corn out there.
I flew over that. I didn't get outside of Des Moines.
Well, let's start. We've got a lot to get to here, and we're glad you're with us, as I said. Let's start with GE, earnings slump today. We always raise this question. They're going through hard times, of course. But from where you stand, does GE still represent a good investment? Boston put a lot of investments on incentives on the table for this multinational giant. Where do you stand on that now?
Well, GE is indeed going through some struggles, revised strategy, selling off some business units and focusing on others. But they're still one of the largest companies, not only in the United States, but on the planet, three times as big as any other company that's based in Massachusetts. The deal that was done to relocate them into Boston, the South Boston waterfront, was for its headquarter operations. They're a very dispersed organization. So the expectation was that there'd be about 800 people working here, including its senior leadership. That's taken place on a temporary basis, construction expected of a new headquarters over the next few years. And they've made some very public statements and commitments to the mayor that they intend to honor that relocation, and it looks like they will.
And honor the job creation as well as the commitments to education in Boston?
Yeah, all of those. The deal that was made with the city was one involving future tax deferral or forgiveness, and all of that was contingent upon delivering on the job creation and delivering on the commitments to education and other initiatives in the city. So, it is not the preferred alternative, but the mayor could pull back on those if GE fails to deliver on what they committed to.
There's also now, though, as you know, as part of the new budget, going to be a review of all of the tax breaks that companies get in the state of Massachusetts. Yeah. It doesn't mean that they'll be eliminated, but among them are, you know, the kind of tax breaks that are used to attract companies like GE and are being used to attract companies like Amazon here. What about that process? Are you concerned that it puts some of these tax breaks at risk?
Well, it certainly makes the negotiations and makes the ultimate deals more transparent. People will know much more about what's going on. Most of the time, these are not cash deals. These are deferral of taxes that wouldn't otherwise be there, or maybe even some future tax forgiveness. But you know, in each of the circumstances that I've seen it used on some hotel deals and other business relocations, it was a situation in which Boston was in a competitive environment. Other cities and states were offering much more. We don't have a reputation for so-called buying the deal. There's been situations where we've lost companies because we didn't put as much on the table. So my judgment is that it's been prudent, and that the good thing about what the budget language includes is that it'll be more transparent, and therefore perhaps maybe people will feel better about it, and not like there's some sort of backroom deal going on.
Jim Rooney is the president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. And Jim, just to your knowledge, have those kinds of tax breaks and incentives actually paid off for the state?
I think that's one of the points, that many times there's commitments that are made, there are expectations of the delivery of a certain number of jobs or other forms of economic activities. And I think the legislators who were driving that wanted to make sure that there was an ability to track the delivery of promises that were made. I don't think there's been anything that has grossly underperformed. This, there were some economic incentives, I know, given to some solar panel companies, I think, that underdelivered. But beyond that, it's not the norm. Look, I'd be lying to say that it doesn't happen. Not everything works out perfectly. But in aggregate, it's the way that cities and states compete for businesses to relocate. And it might feel good, or as a matter of principle, to say no, we don't do that, or that this big company, you know, doesn't need it. But then you're left sitting on the sidelines.
We are continuing our conversation with Jim Rooney, president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. Among the other things we're going to be talking to you about on the other side of a news update, what about Starbucks and the North End and national chain stores? And what do some of your members think of all that? And we also want to know more about the impact of tariffs that Boston businesses have been telling you about.
All right. We're talking, like Pat says, to Jim Rooney. We'll continue straight ahead with all those questions and more. I'm Tom Maroney, Pat Carroll, Peter Barnes. The gang is all here. It's a Friday. Traffic is bad. So listen to Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Some colleges have a novel idea for students who want to avoid a mountain of loan debt. They're offering to pay for tuition in exchange for a percentage of the students' future salaries. Norwich University in Vermont is now the latest school to offer this type of contract, known as an income share agreement. Global news, 24 hours a day on air and at TikTok on Twitter, powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Pat Carroll. Tom and Peter, how about that?
That sounds a little bit like indentured servitude to me. Yeah. Just saying.
A little suspicious.
I want to hit this story just crossing the Bloomberg Terminal right now. Celtics coach is said to have taken bribes while at Penn. Jerome Allen, cited in fraud case involving a Miami businessman, father allegedly gave cash, private jet travel to help his son. And we'll, of course, stay on top of this story throughout the newscast.
Say it ain't so. We'll continue our conversation now with Jim Rooney. He's president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. He happens to be in Iowa today at a big meeting of all chambers. And Jim, as we continue our conversation here, I want to get your take on the big North End brouhaha. Of course, Starbucks wanted to get into the entrance of the North End. Residents said this is going to destroy the character of this great Italian enclave. Mayor Walsh steps in and says, I urge you to withdraw the application. First of all, I want to confirm with you, they've withdrawn at this point, and what's your take on this whole matter?
Yeah, I understand that they've withdrawn. You know, this is, first of all, I'm a big fan of authentic cities, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia. And I like going to a place that has a unique character, a unique culture. And as these big chain stores have, found their way into some of our business districts and neighborhoods, you lose a little something. I was down in Austin, Texas recently, and there was a controversy over a beloved barbecue joint that everyone loved that was being displaced by a hotel development. And the locals were up in arms. But, you know, that's economic development. That's what happens. It happens in old cities like Boston. It's happening in cities, the up-and-comers like Austin and Nashville, they're going through it. And it's all really simple economics. As these cities develop, it's often the national chains that want to be in there. They can afford the rent. And the local mom-and-pop small business find it difficult to do so, and that's kind of the cycle of economics. So glad to see Starbucks appears to have dropped out, and the mayor stepping up to preserve the historic nature of the North End.
But what about this proposal that's now kicking around the city council that would require an extra layer of approval for chains to go into neighborhoods? An additional step through the zoning board would allow the public to come forward and testify and express its interest. Does the chamber support or oppose that measure?
Yeah, we would oppose that measure. I don't think anyone would suggest that there isn't enough process and regulation and in terms of zoning and siting of businesses or other forms of development. I think that the process itself is designed for people to have those conversations and make those points. As we were, over the last couple of decades, having conversations about development of the South Boston waterfront, we were doing our best to make it something that people felt was uniquely Boston. But there again, you know, it's a situation where lots of times it's the national chains that can afford to make the investments, and they go through a process. I don't think we'd support an additional layer of process. I don't think that would fix it.
Jim Rooney is president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. He joins us on a number of issues here on this Friday afternoon. So, Jim, we talked to Councilor Michelle Wu earlier. She has a group working on this, as you know. I wonder what your members are saying. I suppose it kind of paraphrases what you said. I mean, she went through this explanation of how intricate and detailed the zoning restrictions, the bylaws already are that are in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, suppose the council did come up with something. You know, Michelle Wu has a powerful voice there. What would the chamber do in reaction to that? Suppose this did make it into reality.
Yeah, I mean, we would never not listen. I mean, we would certainly try to understand exactly what she or other members of the council were trying to accomplish, to see whether or not, indeed, it really is just an emotional reaction to sort of this situation, or whether, you know, it has the potential to make a meaningful difference while at the same time not inhibiting economic growth and development. I mean, I want to protect neighborhoods as much as anybody. I'm a Boston guy, grew up in Southie, live in Dorchester now, and I want to preserve the character of our neighborhoods. But at the same time, when people are making development investments, time is money, and to add layers of process and another opportunity for people to hold things up, prolong things, force you to hire lawyers, that's not a good thing either.
Jim Rooney, President and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, joining us on this Friday afternoon. Can you talk to us a little bit about what some businesses as members of the chamber have been telling you about the impact of tariffs? There's been so much talk lately.
Yeah, you know, in Boston and in particular, I think the focus of the concern has been on steel and anything related to development and construction. You know, this came up actually as part of my conversations in Iowa with other chambers that are much more targeted, particularly by the Chinese. The Chinese have been very clever in creating a political heat map in terms of what products they wanted to tariff first. So they targeted, for example, the state of Wisconsin, where Speaker Ryan lives, with cranberries. We'll feel a little bit of the effect of that. They targeted South Carolina. They're doing a lot of automobile manufacturing down there. So they've been clever in terms of where they've gone first. As I said, up here in Massachusetts, we've focused on, as I said, the effect on development and construction activities. But beyond the tariffs, the whole trade policy issue, we hear a lot about the discussions about NAFTA negotiations. There's 11,000 companies in Massachusetts that export. Mexico and Canada are our two largest trading partners. The last point I'd make about tariffs and renegotiation of trade agreements is at the end of the day, and this hasn't been felt yet, but it will be, is the cost to consumers. As the cost of automobiles go up, as the cost of other products like vegetables. I mean, think avocados. There's more avocados being consumed out of Mexico than anywhere, and they're a popular item these days. Everyone loves their guacamole. That's going to go up in price, and that's when you'll hear even more and more backlash.
Jim Rooney with the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. Jim, I want to switch gears a little bit. Last month, lawmakers in the House approved a bill that would impose more than $330 million in new assessments on insurers and large hospitals. Also includes assessments on these, I wouldn't call them pop-ups, but they're certainly in response to large, long wait times at different hospitals. These are urgent care centers, retail clinics, surgery centers. What is the business community saying about this? I have a feeling there's opposition.
Yeah, there's a great deal of opposition. You know, the target, particularly in the House, was to try to help out community hospitals that are financially struggling. You know, some of them are a little underwater. Some of them don't have much margin in terms of their operations. And this would be within the hospital and medical services industry, basically a redistribution of wealth where large hospitals would pay an assessment and insurers would pay an assessment, as you said, $300 million. But at the end of the day, people recognize that that money comes from someplace. And the someplace it comes from is from how much a patient or a consumer pays for insurance or at the hospital, or how much an employer pays as their share of health care coverage. And it also doesn't solve the problem. It's a one-time assessment to help with the community hospitals. It doesn't solve the problem. It's an infusion of cash. And the business community really feels like that it's a complex system that needs a lot more attention, not a quick fix that's just going to leave us back here again next year and the year after, talking again about increased health care costs.
So, Jim, what's your sense of this? Will this see the light of day eventually?
Well, the differences between the Senate and the House bill are so great that the Senate proposed a floor on how much the community hospitals can charge at 90% of the average rate for different procedures and you know what is consumed at a hospital. So they're trying to get at the same thing, but in very different ways. There's only about 10 days left in the session. So this one is made difficult by the fact that they have very different approaches. It wouldn't surprise me if they didn't make it on this one. On the other hand, there's some good things in there. There's coverage and incentives for telemedicine and greater applications of technology to the provision of health care that we're very much in favor of. So I hope some of it gets in, but I hope this sort of one-time stuff that really, as I said, not going to fix the health care cost problem is left on the sidelines.
Jim Rooney is the president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. Jim, always a pleasure. Have a straight, safe trip home, and thank you. All right, coming up in our program, I'm just going to say is the following. We are going to be joined by a hitman today in this program. He's been hired by MGM Springfield Casino opening next month. You'll never guess why this casino thinks it needs this hitman. That's all I'm going to say. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. It's Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
Well, State Street Bank announced a $2.6 billion acquisition today, but investors did not like it, sending the stock down 7% a share today in trading. Our Boston Bureau finance guru, Charlie Stein, wrote about it and has this and other stories in his weekly Stein on Money.
Stein on Money!
Report. So, Charlie, what was the deal and why didn't investors like it?
Well, you know, State Street is a bank, or at least it's called a bank. It really handles money in lots of different ways. And pretty much in the finance industry today, all the money goes to technology. This is essentially a technology purchase. It allows State Street to get a new platform to tap into their customers.
Charles River System is
systems. I don't think any of us knows whether it'll work out or it won't. But the markets in general are skeptical of deals. They don't like companies spending money, especially $2.6 billion. And State Street also said it wouldn't contribute to earnings till 2020. Maybe that was a little too long for some people. And finally, on top of that, State Street reported earnings, which were kind of, you know, a little bit on the mess side. And, you know, you put it all together, and the stock was down the most it had been in 2 years. That was a pretty big blow.
And the company said that as part of all this, it's going to suspend its stock buybacks. And, you know, how
right.
much investors like
point,
stock
Peter.
Buybacks.
That's a good point, Peter. That's another thing that people probably weren't too excited about. Another sort of side note to this story is that it created, or at least made us realize, there's another billionaire in Massachusetts. His name is Peter Limbertus. He founded Charles River Systems, the company that State Street bought. It's been around for more than 30 years, so it's not exactly a startup. It's in Burlington. He owns nearly all of the equity, and so he's going to get a big chunk of that $2.6 billion.
So, Charlie said, we also should point out Charles River is a partner with Bloomberg LP, the parent company of Bloomberg News. Let's talk about some of the other stories that are captivating you this week. Ken Griffin says he's a crypto skeptic. I love cryptocurrency stories. What's up with Mr. Griffin?
Do you like him because you believe in it or you don't believe it?
I'm not sure. To me, I'm not into cryptocurrencies. It's a pop culture phenomenon to me.
That's right. And Ken Griffin, a very smart investor, runs a big Chicago hedge fund. And he's questioning the value of them. And he's also kind of lamenting, is the word we use, that younger investors have been attracted to them rather than stocks, rather than real world things. And clearly he's a skeptic. And he doesn't quite come out and say people are wasting their money here, but that's certainly the impression you get after you listen to him. He says, what's unfortunate is the amount of hype and the number of early investors who've been caught up in this hype.
One of the other issues, too, around all this crypto is, you know, good luck with that, since all the regulators have decided to start looking at, you know, at Bitcoin and other things as well.
That's right. And all around the world. I mean, it's not unusual to see the Bitcoin go down because someone in Korea or Japan or China, you know, said something they didn't like. It's Mr. Griffin seemed to suggest there are better ways to spend your money.
But, you know, to be fair, our reporting today, and you can see this story in Bloomberg Terminal, Ken Griffin says he's a crypto skeptic. The reporting says Bitcoin is up about 200% in the past 12 months. So maybe, you know, we shouldn't throw so much cold water on this, Charlie Stein.
Yeah, over the year, if you looked over the last few months, the line is, you know, mostly straight down. Awful hard, I think, you know, whether you're a skeptic or not, to figure out what it's worth. And there's lots of people out there betting on it. Good luck to them.
We're talking with Charlie Stein for our weekly chat. Charlie, BNY Mellon falling as the CEO tells investors, be patient.
Yeah, it was a tough week for the banks like State Street and BNY Mellon. They, you know, they compete. They're in this trust bank space, and investors are impatient. They don't want to be told we're investing for tomorrow. They don't want to know that you're making an acquisition that might pay off in 2020. They want to say, show me the money now. And BNY Mellon is one of those companies. Interestingly, they took their tax cut, which most companies took and then gave out to the shareholders. BNY took a different route. They decided to invest it mainly in technology, another bank spending money in technology. There might be a big payoff down the road, but again, you know, investors are skeptical.
Yeah, BNY shares down 4% in trading today. But we should also point out that BNY Mellon has a huge footprint in Boston. You know, it merged all of a bunch of its divisions here. It has Standish Mellon, which runs about $160 billion in assets and a lot of local workers.
It's true. It's a significant company, especially on the money management side.
All right, Charlie Stein, as always, Stein on Money every Friday here on Bloomberg Bay State Business. Thank you, Charlie. We got a lot to get to in this next hour. I will tell you that the Brockton mayor wants a casino. He was down in Capitol Hill for 6 hours this week arguing with lawmakers, arguing that a certain bill by Senator Elizabeth Warren and Bill Keating, the rep on the Cape, should be tossed aside because Brockton wants the casino, and it seems that Warren and Keating are siding with the Wampanoags down there. So we'll talk about that, but hey. Here's the big story, the big one. We have a hitman on this program. I'm not going to tell you much
you
more than that.
You do enjoy saying that.
Yeah, but it's it's Bloomberg Bay State Business. Who knew that we'd have a hitman? But he's coming up, so stay tuned. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. It's Bloomberg Bay State Business, 106.1 Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
Peter and Tom, it's that time of day.
It is indeed, Pat Carroll. Time for our top story on the Bloomberg Terminal. And it is, in fact, a New York Times story. Michael Cohen, one of the president's personal lawyers, secretly taped Trump discussing payment to a Playboy model. The story says that President Trump's longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen, secretly recorded a conversation with Mr. Trump 2 months before the presidential election in which they discussed payments to a former Playboy model who said she had had an affair with him. Hmm. Tom?
All right, so a lot to get to in this next hour. I hope you're enjoying your ride home, if that's indeed what you're doing, or trying to get on to Cape Cod. I know there's been some backups there, Pat Carroll, right?
It's well, it was a couple hours ago. It was already 5 miles to the Bourne of the Sagamore Bridge.
Five-mile backups. Makes me shiver. In this hour, we will talk about the casinos. A lot going on. Next month, MGM opens in Springfield. In the meantime, there's a little story out of Brockton we want to talk to our analyst Brian Egger about. Brockton mayor wants a casino. Now, here's the problem. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Michael Keating, who represents most of Cape Cod, they want to help out the Wampanoag tribe by overturning a judge's decision last year. The judge said you can't have a casino in East Taunton. So Warren and Keating have gone to the mat for the tribe. In the meantime, the Brockton mayor says if that happens, the odds of me having a casino are shot.
Yeah, this is legislation they would propose, and they have proposed in Washington, that would basically allow the federal government, which does regulate a lot of this through a special commission, casinos opening on tribal lands. It would provide it would allow the federal government to help with this tribe. Right.
Here's the political conundrum, as we say here in Massachusetts. Senator Warren is on record as saying legalized gambling is not a good thing for the state, and yet she's helping the tribe. She's pushing for this casino for the tribe. One would surmise in part because she's trying to make amends with some of the folks who have been very critical of her handling of her of these ancestry criticisms against her, whether or not she's full-blooded, whatever. And so it's an interesting spot that she's in, and we'll get all of this and what it means, of course, for the casino business coming up. And, of course, I'm at liberty to say right now at 5:30, Sal the Hitman will be here on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll, 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
The Red Sox are back in action tonight after the All-Star break. They play the Tigers in Detroit. First pitch at 7:10. Peter and Tom.
Pat Carroll, you know, I've been saying all week this All-Star break is nice, but they're too many days off for the baseball players.
You don't want them to get rusty.
They get a lot of money for what they do. Joining us right now is Brian Egger. We're happy to have him in studio. He is a senior analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. His focus is gaming and lodging. Brian, welcome to the program once again. Let's begin with MGM in Springfield. This is a casino. It's going to open, according to the reporting I've seen, August 24th. This is ahead of schedule, correct?
It is ahead of the original schedule. August 24th is the date. It's going to be at about $1 billion resort. And, you know, the good news there is that MGM mentioned at their analyst day, they did some studies that the propensity to gamble is 10 to 20% higher in Springfield that it is in National Harbor in D.C., where they've also been very successful.
Now, let me stop you right there. How do they know?
How do they know that? That's what I want to know.
Based on market studies. But, you know, that based on the fact that you've got a local population that has no doubt sampled some of the casinos in New England over the course of time, Connecticut and elsewhere.
Because they're not far from the two Native American
Exactly. So, you know, that's a promising property, probably about half the total capital expenditure of the Boston property that Wynn is building, now named Encore. But nevertheless, the Springfield property promises to be an interesting project that really will be the fourth this company has in the greater Mid-Atlantic Northeast.
What's the latest on Wynn? I mean, everything seems to have died down, name change. You know, there was talk about maybe they might have to sell the casino and all that.
Yeah.
The company's totally settled all its problems.
So there are parallel investigations going on. The Massachusetts Gaming Commission and Wynn Resort's own special board committee itself is investigating all the allegations of impropriety, whether or not any other board members or managers might have had any culpability there. But in the absence of anything unforeseen, that property is scheduled to open up next June as the Encore Boston. Of course, they did change the name away from Wynn.
Is the investigation, do we know when it will be done? It's soon, right?
So I think it's fairly imminent this summer, this fall, but they are trying to wind down that investigation. It's both, you know, it's both the Gaming Commission investigating it and Wynn kind of investigating itself to make sure that notwithstanding Mr. Wynn's past issues, that no one from the current management team has any culpability with respect to what happened.
So Brian Egger is our guest. He's a senior Bloomberg intelligence analyst. His focus, gaming and lodging. Brian, last year, a federal judge blocked the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe from their plans for electric casino and resort in East Taunton. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Bill Keating have been trying to overturn that with a bill they call the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Reservation Reaffirmation Act. Wow, that's a mouthful. Where does all this go? And by the way, let's throw this in. The Brockton mayor, Bill Carpenter, says, wait a minute, folks. Brockton needs a casino.
Exactly.
How dare you overturn what's already been settled? Entangled this for us.
So typically when a Native American casino gets built, the Department of Interior has to take land into trust. And that court case you pointed out basically challenged the manner in which that was done. Senator Warren and others are trying to put forth this bill that would allow this billion-dollar tribal gaming resort in East Taunton to move forward. Now, this is touchy because that site, as you were kind of alluding to, is 15 miles from Brockton. Brockton is a location where Neil Blunt of Rush Street Gaming had wanted to build a casino. Remember, when Massachusetts authorized gaming, they allowed gaming in the west at Springfield, gaming in the center of the state in Boston. They never authorized that third permitted, mandated a license for the southeastern part of the state, that Region C. And Brockton had been a favored territory. One of the reasons maybe that never happened was the concern about this Mashapi Wampanoag tribal casino being built. So we'll see. But obviously, the folks in Brockton are basically saying, hey, if there's another casino in either Plymouth or Bristol County, we want a shot at this.
Right.
What are the prospects for Senator Warren's legislation?
We don't really know. I don't really know where it stands, but it seems like this has been something that would require a challenge to the original court ruling. It said the manner in which this land had been taken to trust was inappropriate. So I'm not going to try to handicap it, but I do know that the resurgence, the resurrection of this potential East Taunton Casino for the Mashapi Wampanoags has really revived the interest on the part of the Brockton folks in getting their casino built. And it's not clear whether or not the Massachusetts Gaming Commission will authorize a casino for this part of the state, even if the Mashapi Wampanoag Tribal Casino doesn't go through. But certainly the folks in Brockton want it.
Well, you know, Brian, one of our producers here points out that this would really solidify Brockton's reputation and its motto as the City of Champions. We can go through, that's another long story. But, you know, so if East Taunton is revived or the Mashpee Wampanoags get their casino, so there's a facility there. Here's my question. How many casinos would Massachusetts have, and is that going to be too many?
So right now you have Plainridge Park, which is the racetrack casino.
And they're doing pretty well.
And they're doing fairly well. And that's separate from when the state authorized resort-based gaming. They divided up into regions A, B, and C. A has Boston, B has Springfield. C was authorized, but the license never assigned. So the Gaming Commission has the authority to grant a license for this part of the state, but it has chosen not to, in part because of the hangover and concern that there might eventually be this rival property in East Taunton, the tribal gaming property.
So we could have four then?
That presupposes that if the tribal gaming effort to build in East Taunton went forward, that you would also get a casino in Brockton. I don't know if that's true. But ultimately, it's up to the commission to decide if they want to grant the license.
Well, let's clarify this issue.
Yeah.
The tribe is an independent nation.
Yes.
And the federal government has jurisdiction over whether or not it opens a casino there. So, you know, the state gaming commission, it might just be, you know, tough darts. And we might end up, there's an outside chance, albeit small, that we could end up with
And this
two
may
casinos,
eventually be the governor's decision. This may be kind of a separate deliberative body separate from the Gaming Commission that kind of weighs in on the final determination as to whether or not the Mashapi Wampanoag tribe gets its casino. But certainly, you know, Senator Warren championing this cause brings it back to the fore and therefore raises the issue about what happens in Brockton.
So these decisions, Brian Egger, happening in Massachusetts are not in a vacuum because this Brockton-Taunton area is very close to Rhode Island and Springfield is very close to Connecticut, and they all are talking about building casinos not far from the border. So there's only so many opportunities to gamble for so many people.
That's true, and this is something we've written a great deal about, is that the entire Mid-Atlantic, New England, Northeast gaming market has become increasingly competitive. Two casinos had just opened up in Atlantic City in late June. You've got more mini casinos coming in Pennsylvania. You just had a property opening up in the Catskills in New York State. So this is part of a patchwork of an increasingly competitive Northeast and Mid-Atlantic gaming market. And this just simply adds further complexity to that.
So, Brian, you know, it's just, I remember a couple of years back, people were saying we just have too many casinos. And now we're talking, it sounds like other people are getting into this business. They must look at the numbers. What are they seeing that says, you know what, we don't have too many?
I think part of it is the allure of sports betting, which recently got legalized. And that's something that everybody wants a piece of. Now, the issue, I think, with Atlantic City, which just went from 7 to 9 casinos, and we think it's going to take some business away from other properties in that market, it's not so much that Atlantic City is expanding, but it's expanding at the same time as New York State and Pennsylvania. So you have this patchwork of expansion. But sports betting, interesting, typically not a big revenue generator for casinos, but certainly a traffic generator. The issue is if Jersey has it and Pennsylvania and New York State also have it. It's something you have to have as opposed to a differentiated advantage that allows you to succeed over those rival states.
Mm-hmm. Brian Eger, always a pleasure. He's a senior analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence here at our Bloomberg. His focus is gaming and lodging. It's always good to talk to you, Brian, and we'll certainly talk to you again. Coming up in this hour, 5:45, Boston's not exactly a party town on par with New York or L.A., but Janet Wu tells us why the city's nightlife is about to get more exciting and maybe even more profitable. But at 5:30, yes, as promised, Sal the Hitman, and that's all I'm going to say, a hitman on our program. Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
We've been talking about the emerging casino industry in Massachusetts. The billion-dollar MGM Resorts Casino in Springfield set to open next month. Of course, it wants to make as much money as possible. It is a public company. And the state wants that, too, for its cut of tax revenue. But one thing that could limit both, gambling cheats. To help catch the cheats, MGM has hired an expert consultant. He is known as the Hitman, Sal Piacente. And he joins us now by phone to talk about his work. And Sal, why do they call you the Hitman?
Well, because of my looks and because I killed the competition.
Do you mind?
Not at all.
Well, in fact, it's your shtick, right? I mean, we all been talking about the Hitman and come to find out that's derived from your days as a dealer when the customer would say, "Hit me, Sal."
No, I haven't heard that one, but I'll use it.
Well, tell us then, what's the etymology? What's the derivation of Hitman? You just look the part?
Yeah, it's my thuggish looks, and like I said, because I'm known to kill the competition. Ah. Very few people could do what I could do.
Well, tell us what you're doing with MGM Resorts in Springfield.
Well, I train casinos all over the world on game protection, but there's several people do what I do, but I'm one of the few that actually demonstrate everything. So I'm not going to talk about cheating scams. I'm going to demonstrate them. That way the participants get to see it done hands-on and get to see it done live. That way you get a better appreciation and definitely a better understanding of how the scams work.
So you're training the staff of the casino, right?
Yes, sir. We train dealers. We train dealers on how players could cheat them. You never show an employee what they can use against the house. So you show dealers what players cheat. You show supervisors how dealers cheat. And then you show surveillance everything.
Sal Piacente is the Hitman. He was hired by MGM, the casino that's opening August 24th in Springfield, to help them cut down on cheaters. Sal, what are the numbers? What percentage would a casino assume just goes away, if you will, through cheating, through fraud?
There is no set number. No one really can put a number on
that. What's the highest you've heard? Is it 10%, 20%?
Oh, I wouldn't say that much. But like I said, there's never been a set number on it because no one knows how much is being stolen by theft because only the amateurs really get caught.
Yeah, you mentioned that in a piece I read about you. The amateurs are easier to catch. Tell us about that.
Well, sure, because the amateur has more guts than skill. He'll just make the move when no one's looking. A professional, he'll sit home for hundreds of hours or thousands of hours and practice one move. And when that move is done on a professional level, an untrained eye can actually look at it, watch it happen, and not see anything.
So just tell us about your background then. And you came up through the casino business. I believe you worked in Atlantic City. You saw a lot of cheats, and you, I think I read in your bio, you yourself cheated?
No, not true. Well, how I started, when I was 12 years old, my father showed me the three-card Monte scam that was pretty big in New York City and still being used all over because he never wanted to see any of his children get taken by it, and he showed it to me, and I was fascinated. From that point on, I was so fascinated with sleight of hand, I wanted to learn. And then we moved. We didn't move. We went to Vegas because we were thinking about moving it. And I was about 13, and I fell in love with it. And that was my calling. I joined the Marine Corps, and then when I got out of the Marine Corps, I turned 21 in blackjack school, and my whole life has been nothing but gaming. I've worked every capacity as far as table games goes. I've dealt the games, I supervised the games, and I sat in surveillance.
Sal the Hitman, how typical is it for a casino to hire a guy like you? Are there many Sal the Hitmans all over the country?
There are not. There are not many. It's just a handful. But like I said, what separates me from the rest, when someone else comes in that does what I do, they'll talk about the moves, and you'll see a lot of actual surveillance footage. I do show surveillance footage as well, just to prove that cheating is a reality and always a possibility. But I demonstrate everything hands-on, and that's what separates me from the rest, and that's what makes me a lot rarer.
So give us an example. Tell us about the worst, hardest-to-detect cheat that you've seen in your experience in working in casinos and consulting to casinos.
The hardest detected move is, well, without a doubt, one of the biggest scams that ever occurred was the false shuffle. A false shuffle means a dealer looks like he's shuffling the cards. You could stare at the cards being shuffled. You'll swear those cards are being shuffled, but the dealer is retaining them in a certain order.
Wait a minute. The dealer? So the person working for the casino is cheating?
Oh, correct. That's one of the biggest fears that the casinos has, is one of their employees go corrupt. Remember, if I'm a dealer and I'm not going to cheat for the casino, I'm going to cheat against the casino. If I cheat for the casino, I'm not getting any benefit from it. But if you walk over to my blackjack table and you bet $500 and I could stack you a blackjack or set the cards up, you're making $750. That's $375 each for 5 seconds of work.
So I've been known to go in and play a little blackjack myself. I don't play much, but I do enjoy it. I have a limit, $100. I am surprised that in this day and age, with the eye in the sky, and all of the pit crews that are watching, and the supervisors and the managers and all this, that actually the employees still try and think they can get away with it.
Well, remember now, I've never been in your casinos, I've never been in your surveillance room, so I'm not going to talk about all the casinos. But even though you see thousands of cameras all over the casino, there's only a handful of employees watching them.
So
as far as the surveillance actually catching the move live, that's very, very rare.
So are the most of the cheats are customers or employees?
Well, the majority of the cheats that I've come across, it's usually the patrons. When you say the majority, it's the patrons trying to cap a bet, add to the bet when they win, or take away from the bet when they lose. But when you come across a skill cheat, usually it's the dealer.
Sal Piacente has been hired by MGM, the casino opening August 24th in Springfield. Sal, you've already told us you're training the staff of MGM. Are you staying on board so you can walk around once this casino is open to look for cheaters?
I am not. I usually just do the training and leave because me and my wife, we're getting ready to leave for Macau soon. So we travel all over. So I very rarely get to ever see the opening. We just go in there usually pre-opening.
Have you got a gig in Macau now?
We go to Macau quite a bit.
Yeah.
But you're going as a customer, I assume, right?
No, train.
Hmm. Oh, you're going to go train people in Macau.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of business for that there.
Oh, out there they bet millions one hand.
Wow. Are you gonna train employees at any other Massachusetts casinos? Wynn or?
Do not know. Not yet.
Okay. Tell us, and what kind of business is this? I mean, do you charge by the hour? Do you have a contract? Do you make millions doing this, you and your wife?
I wish I made millions, but no. But as far as with one company, I do have a contract. But usually it's a daily rate. If I get multi-properties, that brings the price down.
A hitman with a contract?
So it all depends. A hitman with a contract. That's right.
Can I just ask, how much do you love what you do? It really sounds like you do.
Yeah.
I have a great passion for what I do, and I really, really enjoy it.
Are you a gambler yourself?
I am not. I am not a player. Remember, I always tell everybody in my training, people lie. Math does not lie. These games are all mathematically designed for the casinos to win. You can't beat them.
That's right.
So maybe the bottom line, Sal, is you got to stay away from the casino, right?
Well, people can get lucky. People, you know, you do hear about stories of people putting that dollar into the machine and hitting a million. People like to go to that table. And, you know, they do get lucky and they do win. But in the long run, you're not beating them.
It's Al Piacente, the Hitman. Thank you for joining us. Fascinating stuff. And if you get to Boston, please come by and visit us. We got a lot more to talk to you about. Thank you, and enjoy your trip to Macau. Well, coming up next, Boston's not exactly a party town on par with New York or L.A., but Janet Wu tells us why the city's nightlife is about to get more exciting and potentially more profitable. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
All right, we'll turn to the lighter side of things now. It is a Friday. It's July, and what better time to celebrate the civic life, the entertainment side of Boston, which isn't known for its partying habits. But something new is popping up in the parks and public spaces, and it's beer, frothy, cold beer. Bloomberg's Janet Wu reports on a big change from City Hall that's now embracing beer gardens.
Just a year ago, they didn't exist, and now they seem to be everywhere. What are these beer gardens bringing to Boston?
New way that people would like to engage with each other in public space, but it's also drawing important revenue opportunities to the ongoing care and maintenance of public spaces, and frankly, it's just making Boston more hip and cool.
That's Mike Nichols of the Esplanade Association. Beer gardens are common in Europe. About 10 pop up seasonally here in Boston or attached to breweries. But now, City Hall is embracing big beer gardens in our parks and public spaces. For a long time, the government wasn't friendly to this idea.
I think that's fair to say. I think the Walsh administration has been really forward-thinking, not just on alcohol, but on a variety of issues in the way that public spaces can be used.
The Rose Kennedy Greenway was first, partnering with Trillium of Canton. With a constant waiting line, that garden was just expanded to hold nearly 400 people.
First few have gone so well. The Greenway Beer Garden was visited, I think, by over 160,000 people last year, and that there were no major issues of any kind. And it showed that if you treat adults like adults, they'll behave in kind. From the Greenway location, the Trillium Garden initially, to now there are five or six or seven of these types of spaces opening up around Boston.
Two more are now poised to open on the banks of the Charles River, one in Herder Park in Brighton, the other right on the Esplanade, just feet from the water near Fiedler Field.
I don't think there's a single better place in Boston to sit and enjoy the day than along the Charles River at sunset with the boats from community boating, the sailboats, the kayaks going by, the sun setting over the Cambridge skyline, Ditko signs just down the river a little bit.
The Department of Conservation and Recreation helped select Night Shift Brewing of Everett from a dozen applications. Here's co-owner Michael Oxton.
I started it two founders 6 years ago. It was just the three of us, and we're now at 90 employees and still growing.
The partnership will form a unique profit share. The Esplanade will get 50 cents from every beer sold to be used for park improvements.
Anyone that enjoys the Hatchell Lawn on the 4th of July fireworks or for the Landmarks Orchestra concert, the Esplanade Association put $750,000 in private funds into the restoration of the Hatchell Oval.
Executive Director Nichols says the money will go to projects like playgrounds and water fountains. Oxton says he's hiring 20 more people for the beer gardens, but the venture has many unknowns. And how many beers are you hoping to sell?
I would love to sell a million beers, but we probably won't get there. Our projections are all over the place.
Right now, the city has no limits on beer garden permits, so brewskis will be a much bigger part of Boston. Janet Wu, Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Never would I think I'd see the day that Janet Wu would say the word brewski, but she just did, Peter Barnes.
I have to say that the story is timely. This is a hot thing in Boston right now.
And how hot?
How hot is it? I tried to go to the Trillium Beer Garden down on the Greenway a few weeks back with a friend of mine from out of town. I said, meet me at the beer garden. I've heard so much about it on the Greenway, beautiful night, all that. I got down. Honestly, the line was probably a couple blocks long.
Yeah.
A lot of millennials who work at the companies around the Greenway.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
Right.
So I ended up going. I just said, you know what? And by the way, they had my friend who wasn't there would have had to wait in line behind me to get in. So I bagged it and said, you know what? Go to a hotel. went out on the back patio, which was empty.
Yeah.
Right? Well, because everybody was at the beer garden.
Yeah. Well, remember, we took part in the Greenway Gala. The Greenway is a strategic partner of Bloomberg, and we were down there that night for the annual fundraising effort, and Trillium was right next door, and that was packed that night. It was a beautiful night. But I'll tell you, on a more sort of, not serious point, but a broader point, I do think the Greenway, you know, they have two beer gardens now, and you know, when I was talking to Janet about this piece, and I, you know, the question is, you know, why now? Well, when you take away the old, ugly, elevated highway and you put a greenway, people start to appreciate the scenic beauty of the city better. And I think this kind of fosters that idea that, hey, let's sit outside and have a beer. I know it's kind of simplistic, but I think it, you know, this is how, in this instance, I think this park really shifted the mentality. Yeah, in some way.
And also, there's money raised for a good cause. However, there are critics of all of this, the beer garden movement, if you will. Mm-hmm. I recall as the Greenway was trying to get, Conservancy was trying to get permitted for all this, there are citizens who are worried about, you know, drinking in public and consequences of that, too. So we'll see how far this proposal goes on the Esplanade.
All right, let's talk about Monday. It's a big day for us here at Bloomberg Bay State Business. We're launching, christening, if you will, a brand new studio. It's a beautiful facility here at 100 Summer Street. It doesn't mean a lot to our listeners, but it means a lot to us. We're going to continue to draw the biggest, the top newsmakers in the city. But it's just a gorgeous facility. It's in keeping with, you know, Peter Barnes's
standards.
Standards. There you go. Standards. But on Monday, one of our two of our guests, Kayak founder Paul English, is stepping down as CEO of his new startup, Lola Travel. He's turning over the reins to another high-profile local techie, Mike Volpe, and both of them will be there. And we'll be glad to have them because we have this glorious new studio, Peter.
Yeah, we're also going to be talking about emerging markets with the top fund manager from Putnam Investments. The emerging markets getting just whacked lately, so you want to get his insights as well.
All right, and Pat Carroll, anything planned for the weekend?
Maybe the beach before the rain.
Yeah, let's hope so.
A beer
garden?
That's what I'm hoping.
It's a half and half weekend. Maybe
yes, that's right.
Beach first, then beer garden second. Who knows? I'm Tom Maroney. He's Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. The gang is all here. We appreciate Janet Wu's piece on the beer gardens. It's Bloomberg Bay State Business, 1061 Boston Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.